This is Greyhound Nation, Episode 5, recorded Monday, September 7th, 2020. Hobby Breeder Panel Discussion. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for Greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound Enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation podcast. I'm Michael Burns, and now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, Greyhound lovers. I'm particularly excited about today's show. It marks the first of our roundtable discussion format shows, and I think you'll really enjoy what our guests today have to say. Now, if you're in the U.S. and plan to have a Greyhound in your life for all of your life, now's the time to start thinking about your long-term plan for keeping Greyhounds at your side. Sadly, American Greyhound racing is declining rapidly, and with it is declining the supply of former racers available for adoption. By the end of 2021, there will be at most two or three Greyhound tracks in the U.S., and so as you can imagine, the demand for Greyhounds as pets will continue to be high, while the supply of former racers will be very low. The good news is that there's a growing community of responsible hobbyist Greyhound breeders who are breeding Greyhounds from racing and coursing bloodlines, and they're going to be of increasing importance as both sources for pet and amateur sporting Greyhounds and for the preservation of the American racing bloodlines. So for today's show, I've asked three of my fellow hobbyist Greyhound breeders to join us to discuss the current state of hobby Greyhound breeding in the U.S., the goals of their breeding programs, and how to go about acquiring a Greyhound puppy from a hobbyist breeder if you're interested in one now or in the future. We're joined today by breeders Audrey Shaw of California, Diana Pickering of Oregon, and Melissa Schmidt of Iowa. Let's go around a little bit around the table here and talk about the goals of your individual breeding programs. Audrey, let's start with you.
Okay, well, first of all, thanks for having me. I feel like I come into this conversation with probably the least amount of experience, but I'll just say that the goals for my breeding program are, I think, primarily to breed dogs for myself first. And I'm interested in amateur sports, so I want to breed dogs that suit those goals for myself. And then secondarily, I want to breed dogs that can make nice pets, you know, both for me and for any other person who might be interested in getting a dog from me, who may not be interested in amateur sports, but is looking for, you know, a nice pet.
Very good. Diana, how about you?
I think first and foremost for me is performance. And when I say performance, that can take a lot of different angles. You know, if you're breeding for, say, racing, you know, obviously you're looking for racing performance. But at the same time, if you're looking for, you know, a coursing dog, or if I'm trying to breed for a coursing dog, I'm looking to breed, you know, a dog that can handle, you know, whether it be Legra or ASFA or, you know, AKC coursing or Notra, I'm looking for performance out of that dog. Now, having said that, just like Audrey had said, I'm looking for people that are interested in performance and in sports, but at the same time, I'm also looking for pet homes because I breed a litter that is specific to what I'm looking for. And I'm looking, you know, I'm breeding for temperament, I'm breeding for health, and I'm also breeding for longevity of the dog, as well as, you know, a good temperament that makes a great pet. And so ultimately, not all of your dogs in your litter are going to be, you know, the performance dog that you're looking for. And so great pet homes are always welcome.
Great, thanks. Now, Melissa, you're a little unusual among our group here in that you have just recently made the transition from being a, a professional racing greyhound breeder to transitioning over to being a breeder for folks wanting pets and sporting dogs. So tell us a little bit about how your goals have changed.
Thank you for having me be on the panel as well. And it's changed quite drastically because the last 13 years, it was for myself or any of my clients to buy race dogs. And when we started seeing the decline in racing, it just actually made me physically ill to think that these dogs weren't going to be in my life, but that they were going to be harder to find for people that really wanted them for companionship or amateur sports or anything. And so I partnered with one of my clients, Jason Sartori, to do the amateur hobbyist breeding. And we've only bred one litter so far, and it was very successful. We had a lot of fun and we met some really nice people.
So you've enjoyed the transition so far?
I have. It's our goal is to continue the history and legacy of the NGA Greyhound, but to get them in people's hands and keep greyhounds and available for people.
Yeah. Well, I'll bat cleanup here in terms of goals. My goals are a little different in that I've since going over to England for the Waterloo Cup for the first time in 1998. I became very enamored of the British open coursing greyhound. They're lovely as the American racing greyhound. They're just built a little different. So I continue to go to England and admire the dogs when I saw them at the various coursing meetings. And when coursing was banned in 2005 in England, I thought it would be a real shame to let that bloodline, that open coursing British bloodline, go away, because breeding of the open coursing greyhounds in England almost came to a stop. There's a couple of breeders who are still breeding there. They take their dogs over to Ireland for the coursing meetings there. But you can't really sustain a bloodline with just two or three people breeding. So I was hopeful to try to help extend that bloodline a little bit. I had two Waterloo Cup standouts to start with, and so I felt like that would be a pretty good way to at least help extend those bloodlines. So that's been my goal. I've mixed in some racing blood. That's always a good mix, coursing and racing. But for the most part, I've tried to keep the at least one parent of each breeding with from the coursing bloodlines. So that's pretty much, you can see there's various goals that everybody has, the ultimate outcome hopefully will be that we preserve these bloodlines that are endangered, both the American racing greyhound and the English open coursing greyhound. So one of the questions we get a lot of times, and we get a great deal on the Greyhound Puppies Forum on Facebook that we're all members of, is how someone should go about looking to acquire a greyhound breeder. How do you find one? What's the best way to find one? The most frequent question we get is somebody will post and say, are there any breeders here in southwestern Michigan? They all seem to think there's a greyhound breeder just around the corner in every state. Diana always has a good response to that. So Diana, let's start with you first. What are your thoughts on how somebody should go about looking for a responsible greyhound breeder?
Well, first of all, I think, a lot of people are used to labs and chihuahuas and other breeds being fairly available. So they oftentimes think, that there should be some breeders just, close by, and they should just find a local breeder and that would be good enough. I think the biggest thing that people need to do is realize that greyhound puppies, there's not a lot of them. And there's not a lot of breeders. And the best thing to do is sit there and spend some time. Watch, the Greyhound Puppies Forum. Look who's breeding. Ask questions. Start to get to know the different breeders. Spend some time doing your homework to see, hey, this breeder is breeding for dogs that like to do agility. Or this breeder is breeding for dogs that, they're still breeding racing. Or this breeder is breeding for show or something like that. But then find out what is it that that breeder is looking to produce? Because ultimately, those skills, those qualities that that breeder is looking for is what's ultimately going to work to make a good pet, right? So, for instance, you know, if somebody's looking to breed a good lure coursing dog, they're looking for good temperament. They're looking for a dog that can run on a lure and not try and fight another dog. They're looking for, you know, health as far as, you know, their structure and trying to make sure that it's a dog that's going to be durable and so forth. That's all stuff that's going to make a great pet, because that's going to be a pet that has a great balanced temperament and so forth. And so I think the biggest thing people really need to do is spend some time getting to know who the different breeders are. Not be concerned where they're located. No, don't be concerned about things like how far they're going to have to go. Find out who the breeders are. What do the breeders do? You know, how are the breeders involved in the breed other than just breeding? Are they out there doing shows? Are they out there doing performance sports? Are they somehow involved in the breed and making the breed better? And then also, I think it's important to ask questions to find out, does the breeder do health testing? You know, can the breeder provide OFA health certificates, you know, on the dogs? Does the breeder provide registration papers? Is the breeder breeding more than just greyhounds? Are they breeding, you know, there's certain things that they need to ask. You know, is the breeder involved, or does the breeder just have a bunch of dogs that they're basically in their backyard breeding? So I guess the question is really, what kind of homework have they put into it? Because the other thing is you want to find a breeder that's going to ask as many questions about you. You want to find a breeder that wants to know you, wants to get to know you, wants to spend some time on the phone, wants to know what you know, your lifestyle is about. Because ultimately, that breeder is going to have some valuable information that they can then match you up with the right puppy for you. As an example, I had a racing litter, and a few of the dogs were not going to be good racers. I think it was around 3 months. They were going to be small, and they weren't I just decided that they weren't going to become racers. And each one of them had a different personality, and I matched those dogs up with the right people. One of those dogs went to a lure coursing home, and it was a perfect match. And I absolutely love watching, you know, how that dog's been developing. Another one was a very laid back dog, and it needed more of a pet home where it can just, you know, it could just love its human. And so the thing is the breeder knows what the different personalities of those dogs are. So the more time that you spend as someone who's looking for a pup, talking to a breeder and getting to know and letting them know, I guess, what it is that you're looking for, they can do a better job of matching you up with the right dog.
And Melissa, how have the puppy buyers that have come to you, how have they found you?
A lot of it's word of mouth, which I can't thank the people enough, because when we're just getting started, especially, this is just a new endeavor for us. Some of them were people that I was racing with, and they'd say, oh, you're looking for a greyhound. And they'll say, you know, look up Melissa and Jason at Harvest Moon. So that the word of mouth is good. I would definitely agree with Diana with the traveling part. I would tell anyone, be willing to travel and be willing to wait. Mm-hmm. Because if you just get a pup that, you know, that isn't properly matched and it isn't from a good breeder, it's just going to cause you heartache in the long run if you're not healthy and if they were not well socialized as a puppy. I think it's very, very important.
Yeah. Audrey, you've been involved in the open field coursing scene in California. Do you get a lot of prospective puppy inquiries through that route?
Well, I've only bred one greyhound litter so far. My other litters were not actually greyhounds, but the dog that I bred, my first greyhound litter, she comes from a pretty well-known open field coursing lineage. So I did get quite a few people asking me for puppies from people who had either had experience with that bloodline previously, either through open field coursing specifically, or people who had puppies from that bloodline just to be pets. So yeah, I did get, I would say primarily interest from people who were familiar with that particular bloodline. So I suppose that could be another avenue for people to check out if they're looking for a puppy, if they have a specific pedigree that they're interested in. Try to network with people in the community to see if you can find exactly what you're looking for.
Yeah. Now we talked, Diana, you touched a little bit on what you look for in a breeder. And there's a lot of terms thrown around on social media. There's puppy mills, there's backyard breeders, and then there's responsible breeders. You touched on a little bit about what some of the attributes of a responsible breeder. What are some of the red flags for a breeder when somebody's looking for a breeder and they find one that might indicate they're not a responsible breeder, or they are a backyard breeder, whatever that may mean?
Yeah, and I think it's a great point that you make, that there's a lot of different definitions out there. So I don't really like throwing those terms around because they mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I would say some of the red flags are puppies going home too young. Puppies should never go home before 8 weeks, in my opinion. In fact, I don't send mine home until at least 3 months. I think that there's still some socialization between 8 weeks to 3 months that they learn a lot of very important skills. I think they're a little bit more able to handle the world at 3 months than they are at 8 weeks. But that's a personal opinion. I think another thing is that breeder somehow involved in the community and doing something that's actually going to improve the breed? Are they using, What are the dogs that they're using to breed? Are they just dogs that they have? Or are they using well-established, lines or dogs that have some type of a record? So, for instance, is it a dog that has a certain amount of coursing ability? Is it a dog that has, if you're breeding for show, that has a certain amount of championships or something like that? And what is it that you're doing? And then not just the female, but what kind of a male are you breeding to? Has the male been also successful? It's just like with racing breeding, you're not going to choose to breed dogs that can't win. You're going to breed the best you have. And to ultimately better the breed. I think one of the things is when I've seen people just contact a breeder and get a dog, with no interview process, no information about, not allowing them to come look and visit the dogs. I've seen where people are just breeding two dogs together because they like them. That doesn't necessarily make, a great bred dog. So, and I've also seen where dogs have been, are being sold, are being marketed just for pets. Pets are great. And we all love our dogs. But I think if they're not breeding for something, if they're not breeding for some type of reason, that's kind of a red flag. If they're not providing health certificates, the dogs aren't going home with shot records, they're not going home with a veterinary check record, and things like this, it can be a little bit of a red flag.
Melissa, let's talk a little bit about what kind of homes you look for, or you want for your puppies, and how you go about screening prospective puppy homes.
We talk to the people on the phone. We Facebook message back and forth, and we actually have a lot of conversations before we even talk about them getting a puppy. Usually they start off by saying, do you have a puppy available and how much? And we say, hold on, back up. We don't want to hear that right away. We want to know what their family looks like, the ages of the people, in the household, what they do for work. Are they going to be around? Because everyone knows that any kind of puppy takes a lot of time and investment to get it into a well-behaving puppy. And we want to know if they have the commitment to do so. Jason and I do not have a formal application for people to apply to get one of our pets, but we basically develop a relationship with them. And after the puppy goes home, we continue that relationship. We're there. We tell them for the whole life of their dog. And it's been fun to get updates and see these puppies growing and how well they're doing. And I guess that's the very rewarding part for me. I hope to eventually get some of our puppies in lure coursing would be awesome. Any sort of sports. We did have one of our buyers that is interested in doing some amateur sports with hers. And one that's in Canada now who's also looking forward to try as soon as the pup is old enough.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think kind of touching on what Diana mentioned a while ago about responsible breeders, I think a responsible breeder is someone that wants to have basically a lifetime of the dog relationship with you, always there to help, support, mentor if they need it. I try to look out for people that might be resistant to that sort of thing. Because if they just want the puppy and here's your check and see you later, that's probably not somebody most of us would be interested in placing a puppy with.
You know, John, and I think you both bring up a very good point. One of the biggest things for me is that, you know, your breeder, as far as the puppy home is concerned, they should look at their breeder as a mentor. You know, when they have issues, they should be able to contact their breeder and ask, hey, how do I deal with this? How do I deal with this? You know, my dog was running and all of a sudden, you know, yelped out, and what should I look for? You know, that kind of stuff. They should be able to contact their breeder and ask questions, or, you know, how do I deal with an earache, or how do I deal with me? You know, my dog all of a sudden is showing a little bit of fearfulness with XYZ, you know, how do I help them? Having that relationship with a breeder is so important. And I think that that's one of the biggest things that I think people oftentimes overlook, but I think Melissa brought up a really great point, which is that is something that's really invaluable. Buying a puppy from a good breeder, you'll have that lifetime relationship throughout the life of the pup.
Audrey, how about you? What's your optimum? We all have acceptable homes, and then we have optimum homes. What's your optimum home for a puppy?
Well, I mean, in a perfect world, every single one of my puppies would go to somebody that lives no more than 2 hours from where I live, who comes to every race meet or lure coursing trial or whatever we do, who likes to send me pictures every week of what their dog does and, you know, how they're doing. But obviously that, you know, we don't live in an ideal world. So I've had to kind of alter my expectations, to be honest. At the end of the day, what I really want for all of my puppies is a home that is going to make a commitment to them for the rest of their life. And I know that sounds cliche, but I've had enough puppies returned to me by people who were not willing to make that commitment. And these were people that, you know, may have made great proclamations to me before they got a puppy about all the things they were going to do and how I would never regret giving a puppy to them, et cetera. And they end up disappointing me because they don't want to keep the dog for the rest of its life. So, as much as I enjoy having my dogs out there doing stuff, you know, in the public eye, I guess, with respect to amateur sports and stuff like that, at the end of the day, I feel like some of the best homes I've ever placed my puppies with were with people who all they wanted was a great pet. And so, I tend to prioritize potential puppy buyers by a few things. I try to prioritize, like if I know somebody personally and they're interested in a puppy, that person is going to probably take priority over somebody that I haven't met before. And if this person who's approaching me is interested in doing sports or you know, hunting, whatever activity they enjoy doing, I might place that a little bit higher on my priority list. But the number one priority is somebody who's going to make a lifelong commitment first. So if I don't get the vibe from you that that's what your intent is from the beginning, then I am not interested in placing a puppy with you.
Yeah,
so, I think my priorities are local, active and committed.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And you know, you touch on that. I don't remember if this was mentioned, but, the lifetime commitment, is important because that's another benchmark of a responsible breeder. It's somebody who puts in their contract or, has the puppy buyer agree that if they ever can't keep the puppy or even as an adult, that it always comes back to the breeder. The breeder should always be prepared to take the puppy back or the adult back if for, you know, life changes or they just decide they can't make the commitment. And I know you've carried through on that several times, and it's not fun for the breeder, but I think it's an important thing for a breeder to commit to. Now, as Melissa referenced, you often get the one of the first questions you get is how much are they? And that's obviously a topic we should talk about because, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions around that. You'll see it pop up on social media and greyhound groups from time to time that everybody thinks of the hobbyist bred greyhound puppies, $2,000, $2,500. So let's talk a little bit about price ranges for puppies and what they go for. Diana, you have some insight on that?
Well, I would say that answer is dependent upon several things. If the breeder is breeding if you're breeding a racing litter, and some of those dogs you're going to sell for lure coursing or for pet homes, you might have spent $2,000 on a stud fee. And if that's the case, obviously the price of those dogs are going to be a lot higher than somebody who maybe used a stud that they had at their home. So I think the other thing is it depends on what the litter was bred for. I think it depends on, some of the economics behind it. I think the other thing is a lot of people need to remember is that breeding isn't really a moneymaker. there's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of health, you know, trips to the vet. There's a lot of things that are very costly that go into doing a litter correctly. And if you're breeding at home, obviously your costs can be a lot cheaper than if you're breeding, say, a champion dog or something that you're paying a stud fee for. So to be fair, I think that, you know, costs anything from $1,000 all the way up to $2,500 are in the realm of possibility. I've seen it go much higher, which I don't necessarily understand, you know, the reasons for those. I've also seen people breed for other reasons that, and then charge extra amount, you know, say $2,500 for special colors or something like that, versus rather than, you know, breeding for a specific and a specific attribute of the litter, such as, you know, an agility litter or a litter that's specifically bred for showing or something like that.
Is price necessarily a indicia of quality? Audrey, what's your thought on that?
I don't believe that it is. This is a very loaded question, but I tend to price my puppies pretty modestly. And obviously I don't think that my dogs are low quality by any means. I charge what I feel comfortable charging. And I think that dogs are one of those things that they're not widgets. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult to set a standard for what's, you know, what price indicates quality versus not. So I don't think it indicates quality. I think, as we've already mentioned many times before, you're better off looking for a breeder that is doing all of the right things than you are just price shopping. I think that price can tell you something, or it can kind of give you an idea of what you're dealing with, but I don't think that people should make their purchasing decisions based on price, either high or low. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I think it's just as bad an idea to buy a puppy because it's priced at like $3,000 and think, oh, I must be buying like the Corvette of puppies because it's priced so high. I've known about enough unscrupulous people who charge whatever they can get without really, you know, making any kind of guarantee about the quality of the dog they're selling, to know that, you know, a high price tag doesn't indicate quality any more than a low price tag does. So I think anybody who's looking for a dog, it doesn't matter what kind of dog you're looking for, you're better off screening the breeder that you're looking at than you are just, you know, reducing everything to price.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, kind of a related question is, you see some breeders justify their prices by the titles that the parents have. Is title an indicia of quality? I'll throw that out to anybody.
Question at me.
Yeah.
I would say yes and no. I mean, if I was looking for a dog that I wanted to show, I kind of think that a show title means something. I mean, it doesn't mean everything, obviously, but it indicates that the person that I am purchasing my puppy from spends enough time going to dog shows that they can get titles on their dogs, which tells me that I probably have a decent chance of getting a dog that will meet that criteria. Obviously, if you're looking for a puppy, like a professional racing dog, there are no titles in professional racing. So if you're looking for titles to indicate, you know, quality, then you're not going to find it. So, no, I don't think titles mean, I don't think they mean everything. I don't think they mean nothing, but I don't think they mean everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Melissa, in your transition, you've had to rethink your pricing, I'm sure, because obviously there's a different price structure for professional racing greyhounds than there is for pet or sporting and companion greyhounds. What's that transition caused you to do in terms of thinking about pricing?
Jason and I had a really long talk in the beginning, and we said that we realized that we cannot sell these dogs for the same amount that we did our race dogs. And so we lowered the price, and it's the same bloodlines. But it was most important for us to make sure that our dogs are affordable for people that want them. And we put a lot of work into the puppies and money into their health and wellness. And we thought it was a fair price. But I think, kind of like Audrey was saying, let the buyer beware. Price does not always indicate quality. At one time I had over 100 puppies on my farm, now I have one litter at a time. People that are breeding for quality puppies or companionship, sports, and they're going to put in the time when they have a few amount of dogs to make sure that that socialization and the vaccinations and the health of the dog comes first. I think that's the breeders that you need to look into to make sure that they're doing the important things to help guarantee that you're going to get a puppy that has a good start in life. So Jason and I were very comfortable at setting our price lower.
Now, here's one that I thought everybody should weigh in on. Choosing your breeding pairs. How do you go about choosing the breeding pairs? And then there's the age-old question, you know, what relative weight do you give individual performances of the sire and dam versus their pedigrees? So, Diana, let's start with you. How do you go about choosing your breeding pairs?
Well, I think it depends on what I'm breeding for. And it depends on the dog. As with anything, you know, you look for a complementary dog that either will enhance certain qualities or continue certain qualities, right? So as an example, I have one bitch that I'm looking at breeding next year, and she's actually got she's actually a very beautiful dog, and she's a beautiful runner. And one thing though, I think that I'd really like to be able to maybe have a litter that would do well in the show ring. And so I'm looking at what dog do I look at maybe breeding her with that's going to maybe enhance some of the things that I do like about her and also keep her functional. So that way, because, you know, if I add some showiness to her, I also want a dog that can still run. It can still run a lure course. It can still be a functional dog and not just be, you know, a pretty dog that can, you know, do well in the show ring. And so I look at different qualities. At the same time, another dog, I might look for, you know, a match that is going to complement her for running. So it just depends on what it is that each match and what you're trying to breed specifically for. In all cases, though, very number one for me is temperament. And I do think that the female has a lot to do. I think, you know, you have to start with a dog that has a good temperament and has good health. But also, I look at performance before I look at pedigree. Pedigree is important, but at the same time, there's just like there was in racing, you can have a great pedigree that doesn't mean that the dog is going to be, you know, super fast, just like, you know, its pedigree was. So I think performance of the dog, temperament of the dog, and then I also look at pedigree.
How about you, Melissa?
I would agree with what Diana said too, but I've been really lucky that my partners, I allow them to choose the breeding pairs. Jason has way more experience in doing so, but he looks at the athletic ability of the sire and dam, as well as the personality. All of our dams have been born here over the last 13 years. And so we know what their personalities like. And I would also agree with Diana that it seems like the females pass on the majority of it, of their personality. And some of the males, we don't know. Some of the males of the ones that we breed have been dead for several years. But we are on Greyhound forums and read about any of the issues that some of the sires, you know, have passed on. And we avoid those if they're not something that we would like in a pet or in any kind of dog, because it makes it harder to train for any sort of sport. So we've been really happy so far with our first litter. The pups have been amazing. The mom was a fantastic mother. And I look forward to seeing what comes in the future.
Audrey, how about you?
I think
I would mostly echo what everybody has said. I, some of the things that are the most important to me are temperament and health. And I think that, again, that comes from the fact that I'm breeding my dogs for me first. And I want dogs that are nice to live with, and I want dogs that are healthy and are not going to, you know, either die on me early, or even just in terms of soundness. I really value a dog that can remain sound. I like to do a lot of, you know, off-roading, so to speak, with my dogs. And so, you know, I really value a dog that I can take out into the wilderness and not really have to worry too much about them. So, so yeah, I care about health and temperament kind of as the first like round of things that I look for. And then obviously I also care about the performance record of the parents. I think if I, just to answer that question about whether, like, the relative weight that I would give to the performance of an individual versus the pedigree, I think all else being equal, I would rather breed to a dog that had a proven record, you know, and not necessarily the best pedigree, than a dog that had a stellar pedigree, but no performance record. And I think that comes down to the fact that I just, with any given breeding, I want to be able to say that I did the best that I could on an individual level. So, you know, I want to say that neither parent had some horrendous temperament or health issue, and both parents had something notable as an individual as far as their performance records were concerned. So, and, you know, maybe that's me just caring too much about what other people might think, but, you know, I just want to be able to say that the ingredients that I used firsthand were good to begin with. So, yeah, I don't know. I think, I think I also try to pick pairs that complement each other. So, you know, if my female has some issues that are, you know, some things about her that are lacking, I'm obviously not going to, I'm going to look for a mate for her that I think isn't lacking in those areas. You know, for example, if my bitch has a slightly squirrely temperament or something like that, I'm going to pick a dog that's, I'm going to pick a mate for her that's very steady, very stable, very calm. And, you know, maybe if I have a dog that is really, really fast on a sprint, but I need a little bit more endurance out of the puppies, then I'll pick a dog that, you know, has a record of being able to run long and do that consistently. So, yeah.
That, you know, you get the occasional question from somebody that's not really particularly interested in a sporting partner in their greyhound puppy, and they'll say, well, you know, why should I care about pedigree or performance of the parents? All I want is a pet. And Diane, I know you've had some thoughts about that before. I've seen some good thoughts issued by you. Tell us what your thoughts are on that.
You know, somebody posted something the other day that I thought was so accurate, and it was like saying that you just want a pet and not caring about whether it comes from a show or a performance breeder. It's almost like asking a builder to build you a home and not caring about any permits or you know, if they have any experience. I thought that was a great analogy, because it's kind of like saying, hey, I just want a house. I don't really care, you know, if it works. I don't really care, you know, how it's put together. It might fall apart, but I just want a house. And it's kind of the same thing. And it's not saying that all dogs would fall apart, but it is kind of saying that, you know, the one thing that somebody who's breeding for something, regardless of what it is, if they're breeding for, you know, lure coursing or open field coursing or showing or something, but they have a goal and they have reasons behind the breeding. They've spent time and energy to figure out, okay, these are the two dogs that are really going to match well with my, the temperament of my dog or what I'm trying to achieve for. And ultimately what you end up getting is you get really nice round puppies. And that doesn't mean that all of them need to go to a sporting home or to a show home or anything like that, because pet homes are wonderful. But the point is that those pet homes are going to get nice round, well-rounded puppies that are going to become great family members. And it's kind of some of the stuff that Melissa has already kind of alluded to, you know, in her breeding.
Melissa, did you get many questions in your first litter about, well, tell me about their pedigree or tell me about their race performance?
We did. It kind of surprised me because I thought we would have, you know, a lot of people that just, like Diana said, just wanted a pet. And so they asked quite a few questions and we would send them to Greyhound Data and show them the pedigree. And since our female was born here, Jason could tell anything about from when she left in the training and what she was like. And so I enjoyed that they wanted to know about the dog's history. That was something that was nice to see, and it kind of surprised me.
Yeah. Now, here's a related question about picking your breeding pairs. And it's a hot button topic on social media, I can tell you. Breeding for color, you know. Who wants to weigh in on that? Audrey, let's try you first. What are your thoughts about breeding greyhounds for color?
What are my thoughts on this? Well, I'll be honest. I think everybody has color preferences. Does that mean that I think that people should breed them only for color? No, I don't think people should breed dogs for really only one reason, you know, regardless of what that is. Because if you're breeding for only one thing, then you're ignoring other things. Do I think it's, do I think color should play no role? I think it just kind of depends on what your market is. I think there are people out there who breed for color, and it's not just in greyhounds. There's a lot of other breeds where this comes up. And I think as long as all the other boxes are checked, you know, as long as you're breeding with other things in mind, like health and temperament, and, you know, if you're breeding a performance breed, you know, then the performance record, then color can be a nice little piece of icing on your cake. And, you know, just as an aside, I suppose, I don't breed for color, but I can tell you that there are certain colors that I, over time, have come to prefer just because they suit my purposes a little bit better. So, for example, I do a lot of open field coursing, and black dogs can be a problem just because they get hot a little bit easier than dogs that are white, for example. So, you know, I could see something like that being a factor.
That's kind of a functional like reason, isn't it?
Yeah. So, and you know, it maybe it's just that spotted, you know, white dogs with spots work better for me for that purposes that I've grown rather fond of them. And I now feel that I prefer that. So it's like a chicken egg thing, you know, which came first, but yeah, I could see something like that being an issue for somebody. But yeah, I don't know what else to say about the color thing, except that I don't want to see somebody breeding just for color in any breed.
Yeah.
If you want to make it a feature of your breeding program in addition to the other things, you know, knock yourself out. But that's not what I do.
Diana, how about you?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think if you're a good breeder, you're not paying attention to color. You're breeding for, you know, the other things that we've mentioned throughout this conversation. And color just happens. And in some cases, you know, you get unexpected colors and so forth. I think when a lot of people are referring to breeding for color, when they're discussing some of this stuff, is there are certain breeders that continually have some of the more rare colors on a constant basis. And they're oftentimes doing that because they're inbreeding, or they're doing certain things to get those colors because they're also charging more for those colors. That to me is somebody who's breeding for color, is when they're getting a very abnormal amount of very rare colors and they're charging more for those colors. Those are people that aren't following some of those things that we've discussed earlier today, which are breeding for, you know, temperament or for performance or for certain things, because those are the things that are just, that are about improving the breed. People that are just breeding for color are basically breeding for a paycheck. So I absolutely disagree with it. I don't think that it's the same as what Audrey was discussing. I think Audrey is discussing it in the way it should be done, which is basically, you know, breeding for performance, for what she's looking at doing. And absolutely, in her case, a black dog could be a detriment, you know, to doing things like open field coursing. Whereas breeding for color is somebody who's just breeding special colors or special markings for a paycheck.
Yeah, and for those, just a little side note, for those that might not be familiar with open field coursing, the dogs can run for a long way, and sometimes it gets a little warm in the states where open field coursing is done, and so that's why the black dog disadvantage. They may... if it's sunny, they're going to, like anything else, a black car, a black horse, they're going to get hotter in vis-a-vis a white
dog. Overheat.
Yeah. So that's I should have clarified that when Audrey was talking about it. Melissa, when you, for your first litter here, for the pet market, so to speak, did you get many color inquiries? And what was your response if you did?
I did. We had two red females, one red male, and then the rest were black males. And the females went immediately. And then the red male, who was really flashy, was picked. And then it was the black males that were the last ones that to be picked. There, a lot of people say, well, what's your next litter going to be like? Well, you know, what are the pairs? And we have two females, and we tell them what color they are, and we haven't decided what males we're going to use on them yet. And so color always seems to come up when someone first comes to us and says, hey, I'm looking for a little brindle puppy, a female. And, you know, we'll do exactly what Audrey and Diana do. We will always breed for personality and for athletic ability, not color. We will never charge more for a different color. I just think that's something that I personally would stay away from. I think that all greyhounds are beautiful, no matter what color they are, is their personalities. But, you know, we realize that some do not sell as well as the others, but we did not stay away from breeding to a black female for our first litter, and it wasn't a problem for us. So I think that we won't change anything that we're doing in terms of picking our sires and dams.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of a purist on the issue. I like Charlie Blanding's saying, a good greyhound can't be a bad color.
Right.
And I have found that when I get an inquiry, I have to bite my tongue a little bit if one of the first questions is, do you have any brindle females, just like you, Melissa?
Yeah.
And so I've found that by not reacting and talking to people a little bit about, you can actually educate some prospective puppy buyers about why color doesn't make any difference.
Right.
You sometimes can see there's sometimes sentimental reasons. They had a greyhound that just died that was red fawn, and they want to try to, you know, have a dog like that back in their life. That's a little different from, you know, we like that color because it matches our couch.
Right.
And so, you know, I try to, I've found that I have to back up and count to 10 when I get that kind of inquiry. So, but I'm on the same page as all of you. I don't think breeding for color is, especially primarily for color, is a good idea.
Now, I do have to add, John, though, you know, everybody has a preference, right? We all go shopping for a car. We're all going to have a different color preference for a car. We have to start somewhere. And I think part of it is, you know, when a prospective puppy breeder, you know, talks to a breeder, yeah, they might have a color in their, you know, their head as to what they're looking for. I think that's where the discussions start coming in, and what Melissa was saying earlier about how she has these long conversations with her prospective buyers. That's where, you know, it's important, because if somebody is just purely, for me, a red flag is if somebody's just purely, no, I want a white and blue dog and that's it. And they don't want to discuss anything else. To me, that's a red flag, right? But yeah, at the same time, if somebody's like, yeah, you know, I saw this beautiful white and blue dog, I'm looking for one like that. And then you start talking to them to find out what they really want, what they're, you know, what's going to fit their home, their environment. And you're like, you know what, I've got the perfect puppy for you, but it, you know, it's this is black female and blah, blah, blah. They change their mind. And it's not necessarily, I think what you can do is it's a conversation starter, as long as the conversation goes further. But I think to me, when people are just purely stuck on the aesthetics of a dog and not caring about the personality of a dog, that's where a red flag can come in. But at the same time, I think a conversation has to start somewhere. Everybody has a preference. They saw something, they're contacting you, they're looking for a certain color. You know, you may have it, you may not, but even if you do have it, it might not be the right personality for them.
Yeah.
So the point is, I think it's a conversation starter.
Yeah, exactly. And I've kind of learned to, like I said, count to 10 and why do you want a brindle? Why do you want a black one or whatever? And then that's a great way to get into, you know, what their reasons are. So in the few minutes we've got left, here's a topic I want to ask everybody about. And it's the term that sets my teeth on edge. Greyhound puppies are land sharks. If I've heard that once, I've heard it 1,000 times. And almost invariably, it's repeated like a mantra by people that have never reared a greyhound puppy. So, Audrey, what are your thoughts about that? How do you keep a greyhound puppy from being a land shark?
Well, puppies are land sharks, if you want to call anything a land shark. You know, all puppies are land sharks. So, and I've raised several different types of puppies, not just greyhounds. So what I always say to people who like to talk about greyhound puppies being land sharks is I just say, you know, puppies are all basically the same in certain respects. They all have puppy teeth that they need to, you know, chew with. So they will chew on things. They all have a lot of energy that you need to address. They all have to go potty every 20 minutes. they all have to learn how to be in a crate. They all have to learn how to be alone. They all have to learn the rules of the house. They all have to learn how to walk on a leash. They all have to do all these things. And greyhound puppies are no different than anybody, you know, any other kind of puppy in that regard. So I don't really know why greyhound puppies in particular get that kind of reputation. Maybe it's because most people only ever meet greyhounds when they're, you know, fully mature adults. But I guess your question was, how do I keep mine from being land sharks? I take care of their needs, whatever their needs are. I have a lot of toys around my house. I also have a lot of dogs. So my puppies are never alone. They always have somebody keeping them company. Either, you know, when I'm home, they can play with each other. If I'm not home, you know, and they're in a crate, then there's other dogs nearby. If I am going to leave them for any length of time, I confine them, but I make sure that they have things to chew on. You know, all puppies need that. You're not going to get away from that, that one need that they have. And I, the other thing I always tell people is that, you know, a tired puppy is a good puppy. So yeah, if yeah. you are taking the time that they need every day to get out their energy, they're going to be a lot easier for you to deal with. They're going to be a lot less interested in causing trouble. So yeah, those are my, that's my advice for everybody is, you know, tired puppy is a good puppy and all puppies are basically the same.
You know, I don't have a lot of frame of reference myself because other than the odd whippet puppy here and there, I've only had greyhound puppies and I haven't found them to be particularly difficult to rear. I'm always pleasantly surprised when this topic comes up on a greyhound forum that somebody says, well, I've had borzoi, I've had deerhounds, I've had, you know, Australian shepherds, whatever the breeds may be. And they'll say greyhound, the greyhound puppy I reared was one of the easiest I ever had. So that's always, always nice to see. Melissa, what about you? What do you think, what do you get from your puppy inquiries and what do you tell them?
I've had a lot of different breeds and geez, you have a Great Dane puppy and you'll know about land sharks because you're getting thrown down to the ground. but I completely agree with Audrey. They're all puppies are land sharks. I think the problem might have started when people are used to adopting retired racers that are a year and a half to 4 years old and they're the easiest dogs they've ever had in their whole entire lives. And then all of a sudden they met a greyhound puppy. They're a lot different, but in terms of other breeds, a puppy's a puppy. They have sharp teeth, they have sharp claws, and they like to chew and they like to play. And if you keep them content, they're going to be a good puppy. And the biggest thing is what are you molding them into for an adult dog? If you get a puppy and just stick it in a crate and don't interact with it, it's not going to be a happy puppy and a happy adult. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it's so important for breeders to screen their homes. Are they going to have time to put in with a puppy what needs to be done?
Yeah, absolutely. Diana, how about you? What do you tell folks when they ask you whether greyhound puppies are land sharks?
Well, you know, I think that some of that came from, you know, when you would visit puppies, for instance, on a greyhound farm. And they're all together with their litter mates. If you go into their pen, yeah, you're going to have 10 puppies. They're all vying for your attention and jumping up on you and, you know, with their sharp teeth and everything like that. And I think that that's probably where some of that came from. But I will tell you, they're a lot different in your home than they are when you're out at a, like say a greyhound farm where, you know, there's a whole bunch of puppies and stuff like that. I've taken my own where I had some greyhound puppies on a farm and I took some home and I brought them home into my own home and they completely changed and they weren't so land sharky. You know, they actually calmed right down and took to the household. And, you know, when you're redirecting them with toys and you're redirecting them with other things to do, they're not so much of a land shark, but they're just puppies, just like Audrey and Melissa were saying. I think a lot of it is just about, you know, are you the person ready for a puppy in your home? Have you, I guess, puppyized your home? I think the very first puppy I brought home, one of the things is I thought my home was ready for a puppy. I found out that it wasn't. She found papers everywhere. You know, she would find something and she would rip it up. Well, that was my fault for not, you know, making sure that certain things were out of her reach. And that was just things that I had to go through as a first time puppy owner. And that's the type of thing that I think a lot of people that have fallen in love with greyhounds because they've had former racers, but they haven't gone through the puppy rearing stage. And they have to sometimes go through that. And that can be a little bit of a sharp lesson because they've not had to experience that type of stuff. They've not had to deal with learning how to crate and learning how to potty train and learning how to, you know, kind of puppyize their home and keep a puppy occupied. However, I will also say that bringing up a puppy from puppyhood is also one of the most rewarding experiences as well. And I think that the bond between your dog is always so much stronger when you've reared them from a puppy.
Yeah, absolutely. To me, if you've got the facilities for it and the patience and the time, it's an experience not to be missed in kind of your Greyhound life. I think at some point, you know, everybody should give it a shot if they've got the time and the facilities.
I mean, I just think that they're so much more trainable that way. You end up learning. I mean, there's just so many benefits to it. And I think it's a really a great experience. I just think that you do need to go into it with an open, with your eyes open, that it's not the same as getting a retired racer. That doesn't mean that they won't become the same, but there's a whole puppy experience that, that you're not used to going through. Yeah. And it, as long as you're open to that and willing to learn with that, it can be the most fun experience ever.
Absolutely. Well, folks, this has been a great conversation. Our time is running close. Many more topics to discuss. We'll definitely have everybody back for a part two. I've got about another 10 questions we could delve into. So thank you all for participating. It's great to have knowledgeable people like you to come in and help people understand what hobby breeding is all about in the Greyhound world, what puppies are like, and it's been great having you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe to Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. You can also write to us via the contact form on our website, greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. We're also on Facebook. Search for our Grey Nation Show page. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taurus. Thanks also to the members of this episode's panel discussion, Diana Pickering. You can find her on Facebook at Pacific Greyhound Kennel. Audrey Shaw. She's available at stoutheartedhounds.com. And Melissa Schmidt of Harvest Moon Greyhounds on Facebook. You can learn more about our panelists, hobby greyhound breeding, and more on our website. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.